You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. Happy Friday. I'm Bill Radke, and my guest this hour, talking about the top news of the week, Erica C. Barnett, who writes at thecisforcrank.com. Marcus Green edits the community news website South Seattle Emerald and contributes to Yes Magazine. Knute Berger is the Mossback, writing for Crosscut. Hey, everybody.
Hello.
Hey, Bill.
Hey. Thanks for coming in today. We're going to begin with the fact that this week Seattle's mayor and one of the city council members were texting each other about the city's work on homelessness. Mayor Murray wanted to get people out of the homeless encampment known as the jungle. Councilmember Sally Bagshaw wanted to give people who live there more time and more services before they had to leave. That's the boiled down version. So Murray sends her a text that says if she pushes for her approach, quote, "I will stop all cleanups throughout the city and pull police off enforcement." Erica, what is he saying he'll do there and why?
Essentially, what he's saying is that he will pull police away from enforcing the laws against camping. So neighborhoods have complained quite a bit about the fact that there are homeless people camping in not just the Greenbelt, the jungle, but throughout the city. There are encampments in the Ballard Locks. There are encampments all over the place. And his threat was, I'm going to stop taking care of that and you'll see what happens.
So the idea is that having police back off means more crime, so neighbors are more upset and want more of a Murray-style crackdown? Is that the idea?
I think that is the idea. There's also, you know, a lot of feeling that there's crime associated with RVs. And so I think his threat was, you know, let's see what happens when I unleash this and when I stop enforcing these laws. Now, how serious that threat is another question, but that was the implicit threat.
Okay,
or
so
the explicit threat.
We're going to talk about yelling in a moment, but first I just want to stop there and get group reaction. Does that seem out of bounds, Marcus, for the mayor to suggest that?
I mean, to be honest with you, as we were speaking earlier, I sent this story to a friend of mine over at the Chicago Tribune, and she was like, "Is this actually a story?" I mean, you know, she's used to a mayor in Rahm Emanuel who's, you know, speaking pattern essentially a noun, verb, and profanity. So,
right, yeah, that's the is this news anyplace outside of Seattle, but comparable size city?
No, I mean, I think this is like, you know, if this is especially back east, right? I mean, this would barely be a blip on the radar, and here it's, you know, front page news. That being said, right, I mean, as a journalist, I mean, this wasn't, I don't think I'm going too far out on a limb here with saying this wasn't even the, most, strident that I've heard of, you know, Mayor Murray in,
yes,
in his dealings with people. So.
Yes, and we're going to talk about that. Knute, you agree this is, is this outrageous to you that the mayor would suggest backing off? Because he's been accused of his police department not fully enforcing the law, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, people have been dissatisfied with all kinds of things. But the mayor, you know, he, as Marcus was alluding to, he's got a reputation of having a temper. And it's something the public doesn't see a lot, but people who, you know, work with City Hall or worked with him in the legislature or whatnot are aware of it. And we so seldom do we get those kinds of little intimate views of like a council member and the mayor having a testy exchange. So we're getting to see the text sausage being made. And so it's kind of titillating from that standpoint. But yeah, when you measure it on the Richter scale of not niceness in metropolitan politics, it registers pretty low.
In this text exchange, Murray quotes one of his staff as saying Bagshaw doesn't want to talk to Murray because Murray might yell at her. And Murray does have a history of some yelling
and his
profanity.
His response is, "I have never yelled at you."
I've never yelled at you.
Who knows whether that's true? I've certainly been yelled at by Ed Murray.
Why did he yell at you?
Oh, I don't. I mean, who can remember every time? I mean, you know, he is a dude with a temper. I mean, I remember when I first started back at the Weekly. I think before you even had quite come back yet, Skip, in 2001, I was a new reporter here in Seattle, and I remember him, you know, just screaming at me. I think he was a state legislator, maybe a representative, and about something, who knows, and, you know, hanging up the phone, slamming the phone down on me, and I just got off the phone, and I was like, who was that guy?
So the theory is that we don't want yellers because people around them feel intimidated. You were not intimidated.
Well, and sometimes intimidation, especially in the city, works. I mean, if you look at the $15 minimum wage, one of the reasons that those, you know, that diverse coalition of people was able to pass a minimum wage that high and, you know, and reach a compromise is because Ed Murray locked him in a room and screamed at him. And, you know, and sometimes, I mean, you can call it bullying or you can call it threatening, but sometimes that actually does work and it gets us outside of our comfort zone of being nice about everything and never getting anything done.
Well, yeah. And even if you're a dyed-in-the-wool Seattleite, you're going to get annoyed with Seattle process. And mayors and council members, you know, are herding ducks, and those are ducks are nibbling them to death at the same time. You know, who can blame them for getting
that's
getting,
a great image, getting herding testy, the nibbling ducks,
herding nibbling ducks.
Ouch,
yeah.
Ouch,
exactly. And I also think part of it may be that, you know, as Seattle grows as a city, become a bigger city, we're going to adopt certain big, you know, bigger city styles. The mayor, you know, was very happy to hire people out of New York and Boston and other political climates where this is the norm. So I'm not sure. You know,
His police chief's from Boston.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, as relates to Seattle processiness and niceness, a consultant at the city had brought in to help us address homelessness said that our city moves too slowly because we overthink things. Her name is Barbara Poppy, and she told King 5 that our city over-deliberates, which results in a Seattle process that
goes on and on and on. You all live here. You tell me. I mean, I'm from Ohio. I mean, we're, you know, you just got to get stuff. You got to get stuff done. There's a more practical can-do, how do we get stuff done, culture there.
A more practical can-do, how do we get stuff done culture. You buy that?
Well, I think with the subject that she's talking about, homelessness, it is incredibly complex. And I do actually think that I don't think that we need so much buy-in from every single individual that might be impacted like we usually try to get. But I do think it is a complex process. And, you know, we shouldn't just say, OK, let's try this. And then because things are at stake here. I mean, there are real stakes. And, you know, whether it's the thing the mayor announced yesterday, this drop-in center / shelter, that kind of came out of nowhere. And I don't think that is a good way of making policy either, like not having any deliberation and just doing, you know, the next flashy thing that comes across your desk.
Well, beyond city government, we also have a reputation of being just Seattle nice in general and standoffish. Marcus, have you ever yelled at someone at work or been yelled at in Seattle?
I have certainly been, you know, experienced both, yes.
Oh, yeah?
No, I mean, I think, you know, we have this reputation for this very easygoing, you know, populace where we want to get at least 95% of people on board and want people to like us. I think we have this reputation for niceness as opposed to kindness, you know. Niceness is this veneer of likability as opposed to actually caring about somebody, right? I mean, it's the old Seattle Freeze thing. I'll say hello to you and how are you doing, but I don't actually care how you're doing.
Mm. We're actually going to talk a little more about this, as it turns out, in about 15 minutes in a different context. But yeah,
a bit of a teaser there, I guess.
Yeah. Have you yelled, Knut? Been yelled at?
Yeah, both. I think when I was, you know, editing magazines and newspapers, I think I was pretty genial but once or twice a year, I just pop my cork.
Yeah.
I'd yell at a writer or whatever. And I also, you know, in those deadline-driven environments, you know, are pretty tense. I one time had a guy who worked for the publisher grab me and practically rip the shirt off my back in a act of hostility. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, it's like, hey, let's go have a beer. You know, I mean, it's a very odd thing. There are people who are abusive in those environments, and there are other people who just kind of, you know, have a short fuse, and then it's over.
So what are we going for? What's our ideal? Because I would suggest, I'm not a yeller, but I still would like that our workplaces to be a place where you assume that if someone is popping their cork, it's a professional disagreement. They care. They're frustrated in the moment because we're emotional human beings, and that. But this doesn't have to be an HR situation. This doesn't have to be an emergency because somebody raised their voice. Any with me, against me? Do you want to yell at me?
I would, I'm with you.
I would blow out the mic if I yelled. I am personally a person who has to really rein it in.
You're a rager.
I am. I mean, I get very, you know, I have a very strong sense of justice. I get really mad when things are not going the way that I think they should be. I'm a journalist, and you know, Knut is right. In those sort of deadline driven environments, I mean, I have certainly thrown a phone at the wall. I've thrown a computer at the wall when it's, I think most of my rage actually on reflection is against technology.
that is true.
The machine.
But I've certainly worked in environments. I mean, I worked at a paper once, not here in Seattle, where, the editor and publisher were both rageaholics, and you know, and some of our editorial decisions became sort of based on fear. I remember in particular one year that we endorsed, we endorsed Ralph Nader, and then based on the whim of the publisher, and then the next week we had to endorse Al Gore based on the whim of the editor, and then the next week we ended up doing a dual endorsement. And that's just embarrassing.
Sounds familiar.
That's not exactly consensus.
It was the closest we could get.
Yeah. Yes, Knut.
Oh, I was just going to cite one war story, which is an example of rage benefiting me. At one of my very first jobs working for a magazine in the Silicon Valley, the managing editor attacked, physically sucker punched the publisher and broke his hand, actually hitting his head. And and then the publisher made me replace. I was instantly promoted to replace the managing editor.
Oh.
And I was like the intern.
Wow. That's like a win-win, except it's a win. It's a punch win situation.
Is the magazine still around?
No, it is not.
Okay, Marcus. Any final word on this? What's the ideal approach to yelling and hot-headedness? What's our sweet spot?
I mean, I think the sweet spot ultimately is the outcome, right? I mean, you know, I'm not a yeller myself, but you know, there's certainly, you know, you look at somebody like a Steve Jobs or a Rahm Emanuel or, you know, a Chris Christie, right? I mean, these are people who, you know, get things done, you know, whether you agree with their methods or not. So, I mean, I think that has to be the ultimate judgment. I mean, I was talking to my father about this earlier this morning, and he was saying, I really could care less what the mayor does as long as he can, you know, clean up the streets and get this income and inequality thing, you know, put together. I mean, I think that's the ultimate. Ultimately, I think that's the, you know, that's the, you know, ultimate judgment, if you will.
That was the Seattle Mayor Ed Murray's spokesperson, Marcus Green's father, on KOW's Week in Review. We're going to keep talking about the news of the week, Muhammad Ali. And as I said, we're going to get at this Seattle niceness. As Marcus said, we're nice, but are we friendly? We're nice, but do we care? And then could Sanders and Clinton supporters come to care for each other? Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Knut Berger, Marcus Green, and Erica C. Barnett. When Muhammad Ali died this week, we remembered his boxing, we remembered his rhyming, and we remembered the personal price that he willingly paid to be political.
There have been many questions put to me why I refuse to be inducted into the United States Army, especially as some have pointed out, many have pointed out, when not taking the step, I will lose so much. And I would like to say to those of the press and those of the people who think that I lost so much by not taking the step, I would like to say that I did not lose a thing up until this very moment. I haven't lost one thing. I have gained a lot.
Cassius Clay became Muhammad Ali. He joined the Nation of Islam. He refused to go into the military. And some other star athletes of his time backed him up. Bill Russell, Jim Brown, Lew Alcindor boycotted the Olympics and changed his name to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Can you name a politically controversial athlete today?
Yeah, silence. I mean, it's hard. I think the corporate nature of a lot of big-time sports makes athletes stay quiet because they don't want to lose sponsorships. I think there's a lot of pressure to keep politics out of the locker room so that, you know, football players don't have to fight over those things, too. You know, Richard Sherman comes the closest locally to anybody who says anything political. I mean, he was saying the other day that he was against billionaires, the taxpayers paying for billionaire stadiums.
That's right,
and,
just recently.
And saying that, yeah. So, you know, occasionally he'll wade in on race or some other issue. But at the level of Muhammad Ali, I can't think of anybody.
No, I mean, the only person I can think of for all the wrong reasons is, you know, Dennis Rodman when he, you know, was the, I guess, the best friends of the dictator of North Korea there for a while.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I think athletes today, they, you know, don't want to, you know, face, you know, unpopularity. The thing that we don't remember about Muhammad Ali with all these, you know, sort of this revisionist history where, you know, no one voted for Nixon and everybody cheered Muhammad Ali was that a majority of Muhammad Ali's fight, 70% of the people would be against him. They wanted to see him fail. You know, this was a man who was not popular for speaking his mind at the time. Nowadays, athletes, they kind of go the Michael Jordan route as opposed to the Muhammad Ali route. You know, Michael Jordan famously refused, in, I believe it was 1992, to come out against, I think it was Senator Strom Thurmond, excuse me, Senator Jesse Helms at the time, who was, you know, notorious race baiter because he said Republicans buy shoes too.
Right.
These are, you know, this is people who we've seen, you know, athletes nowadays who, you know, do not want to, and they give up on millions of dollars as Muhammad Ali, you know, did when he refused to enter into the draft. Do not want to, as Knut was saying, give up on their endorsements. They, you know, want to build a brand. They want to go into corporate America many times after they retire. And the way you go into corporate America, at least as a black male, is somebody who is non-threatening. You know, somebody who, you know, does not make waves. Somebody who is, you know, the Wayne Brady, Sammy Davis Jr. types, who, and no disrespect to those people, but who, you know, just will kind of go along to get along.
Here's what I don't understand about that. In 1964, Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, couldn't have known that he was going to give up his title and then come out the other side repeating as world champion and being, you know, being world famous and beloved. But so he was risking so much so early in his career, whereas Kobe Bryant, you know, Michael Jordan, these people have so much money. Why would they feel beholden to a few more million dollars from some sponsor? They've got, if it's money, they've already got it.
Well, what Ali did, it's called courage. I mean, it's the definition of courage, right? You don't know that you have a life raft on the other side. You know, people like, again, people like Michael Jordan, people like Kobe Bryant, as great as they are athletically, is sort of as, you know, inversely as, you know, maybe it's a strong word here, but as cowardly as they sort of act when it comes to, you know, social justice issues.
But cowardly, what could they lose? You can't make Michael Jordan poor.
No, but you can certainly knock him off at the pedestal, right? Mm. You can knock him off. No, he doesn't need money, but you still need, you know, adulation. You still need reverence. You still need, you know, ego and narcissism fed.
I would suggest that those folks that you mentioned, I mean, it's also possible that they are not, you know, intensely political people. And I look, I'm way outside my area of expertise on any sports related subject. But, you know, I also think that there's not an obligation of every celebrity to have, you know, strong opinions and be, you know, able to speak well on issues. And, you know, and I think the example, I can think of a ton of examples of celebrities who have strong political opinions that they maybe should not be expressing, like Jenny McCarthy on vaccines, but or Susan Sarandon on Donald Trump. But, you know, when I was trying to think of sports figures, I came up a little blank, except for Serena Williams, who is not someone who speaks a lot on issues, but who has kind of been thrust into the position of being political by the fact that she gets, you know, so criticized in a way that's frankly racist and sexist for being, you know, a physically powerful looking black woman. And I think that, you know, so she's sort of been thrust into being a political figure in that way and has, you know, really become kind of an icon for her power and for her strength and for, you know, the fact that she is unapologetic about that and doesn't try to be more, quote unquote, feminine and invisible.
Right. She could say no comment, but she doesn't. She addresses that stuff.
And I think she addresses it head on and, you know, and in a really powerful way, which, yeah, she could say no comment. Absolutely.
Right. Right. I mean, that being said, though, I mean, I would disagree with saying that they don't have any obligation to speak out. I mean, I think any and every citizen in a democracy has an obligation to speak out. And just because these people, you know, hold some sort of celebrity status that you know, they shouldn't mute their comments or opinions, you know, whether we agree with it or not. But I mean, I do certainly think that having a platform as Muhammad Ali did at the time and, you know, what was going on with, you know, within the civil rights movement at that time, yes, he did have, for me at least, I think that he did have an obligation to speak out, as I believe that athletes today have an obligation to speak out when they see, you know, injustice that are blatantly, you know, committed regularly in this country.
You reminded me of LeBron James putting on a hoodie, which I'd forgotten about, around the Trayvon Martin case. Did he pay a price for that? LeBron James is about the top athlete that we've got right now. Right?
Yeah, arguably, right? I mean, love him or hate him. I mean, I would say that I think he did pay a price in the sense that there were, you know, that he couldn't be as much of a crossover person as, let's say, Michael Jordan, right? I mean, you still had comments and tweets saying, I remember one in particular, you know, what are these monkeys in these hoods doing, right? You know, say, I mean, grant you, you may not have paid as steep a financial price since that, you know, type of behavior is, you know, thankfully not welcomed in our society at this point. But, I mean, I do think that it was, you know, courageous to do, especially when so many athletes, you mentioned Kobe Bryant earlier, you know, very much did not think that was something, an act that LeBron James should have been doing.
I'm going to play you one more clip of Muhammad Ali, because who doesn't want to listen to Muhammad Ali?
Won the Olympic gold medal in Rome, Italy. Olympic champion, the Russian standing right here, and the Pole right here. Is Poland considered a communist country?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm defeating America's so-called threats or enemies. And the flag is going, ton, 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 ton. I'm standing so proud. Ton, 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 ton. And I done whooped the world for America. Ton, 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 ton. I took my gold medal, thought I'd invented something. I said, man, I know I'm going to get my people freedom now. I'm the champion of the whole world, Olympic champion. I know I can eat downtown now. And I went downtown that day, had my big old medal on, and went in the restaurants. At that time, black things weren't integrated. The black folks couldn't eat downtown. And I went downtown, I sat down, and I said, you know, a cup of coffee, a hot dog. He said, the lady said, we don't serve Negro. I'm so mad. I said, I don't eat them either. Just give me a cup of hot dog.
Muhammad Ali, who's being remembered in Louisville, Kentucky today, and you're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Coming up on the program, do you have a moral obligation to be a prepper? Stay tuned. I'm Bill Radke. This is The Week in Review. Marcus Green edits the community news website South Seattle Emerald. Erica Burnett writes at the CIsForCrank.com. Knute Berger writes at Crosscut, where he's the Mossback columnist. And this week, Hillary Clinton made history by being the first woman to be, qualifier alert, first woman to be her major party's presumptive nominee for president.
Tonight's victory is not about one person. It belongs to generations of women and men who struggled and sacrificed and made this moment possible. In our country, it started right here in New York, a place called Seneca Falls in 1848. When a small but determined group of women and men came together with the idea that women deserved equal rights, and they set it forth in something called the Declaration of Sentiments, and it was the first time in human history that that kind of declaration occurred. So we all owe so much to those who came before, and tonight belongs to all of you.
And did Clinton's opponent, Bernie Sanders, take that historic opportunity to line up behind her in support? He did not.
I am pretty good in arithmetic, and I know that the fight in front of us is a very, very steep fight. But we will continue to fight for every vote and every delegate we can get.
Bernie Sanders, of course, won the state caucuses in Washington in March, and his campaign is still trying to influence next week's Washington Democratic Convention in Tacoma. Instead of the state Democratic Party chair holding the gavel, the Sanders campaign wants one of his supporters in the state legislature to be convention chair. So America has been hand-wringing about, is the Republican Party falling apart? Knute, should we be hand-wringing instead about how whether the Democratic Party is falling apart?
Well, yes. I don't think the Democratic Party's falling apart, but it's changing, and with a new generation. And there are threats to it in the sense that some Sanders supporters, socialists, would like Sanders to run as a third-party candidate. I don't believe he'll do that, but they would like that. They would like to capitalize on the grassroots organizing that Sanders has done, but not line up behind Democrats on local races and that kind of thing. So, you know, I think it's all the more important that they find a way to knit things back together, because they have a real opportunity to win in November. And the kind of fracturing and negative campaigning that's happened so far makes you worry. This week, Sanders seemed to be making all the right statements after that speech that we just excerpted there. So it looks like he's going to take a very positive role. But that doesn't mean all his followers will.
Right. That's the next question, right? Do you see any sign, Erica, that the voters, Bernie Sanders voters, are going to fall in line?
Well, I think that the polls have shown that most of them will. I think something, the most recent one I saw was 71% say that they will support Clinton. So so I think that yes, I mean, fall in line in the sense of voting for their party. Absolutely. I think the ones that will not, say, like here in Washington State, you know, are really inexplicable to me. I mean, in the sense that their guy lost. and this is a populist movement, supposedly, right? And so now they're trying to rely on superdelegates and changing caucus rules in a party that they have never participated in before, you know, and may never again.
What do you mean they've never participated?
I mean, if you're talking about a lot of folks are saying that the reason that Hillary Clinton's wins have been illegitimate is because people have been excluded who declare themselves independents, who can't, you know, who don't declare themselves Democrats. So, I mean, you're talking about a lot of people who are maybe socialists, who are, you know, not affiliated with any political party, wanting to come in and change a political party that, you know, that they have never wanted to be a part of before. And I'd say the same thing of Bernie. I mean, he's not a Democrat. He caucuses with the Democrats, and he was happy to take their money during this campaign. But he is, you know, by no means a Democrat. And so I feel like, I mean, I have a lot of feelings about this, and I think listeners may know that I am a Hillary supporter. I feel like this is the ultimate tantrum of, you know, saying our guy lost the popular vote. He lost the delegate vote, and he lost the superdelegate vote unless a miracle happens. So we're going to keep fighting and try an undemocratic way of making it so that, you know, by hook or by crook, somehow he's going to carry it through and win. And I think it's just, I think it's the height of bad loserdom to.
But why undemocratic? It's within the rules, right?
Right.
It's not a coup.
I'm taking their words at face value, and they believe that the superdelegates are undemocratic. However, they're going to rely on the superdelegates. That's the only way that they can see to win now, is to rely on this structure that they say is completely undemocratic. Once they've used it to win, which they won't be able to, but if, you know, in this fantasy world, Then they're going to dismantle the superdelegate system because it's undemocratic. I mean, there's nothing about this that makes any sense except that they're mad that their guy lost and they don't want to admit it.
Consistency is the hobgoblin of complacent little minds, though.
Yeah, I will be very interested to see if any of these folks are still involved in the Democratic Party come in 2 years when Congress is again at stake.
Marcus, any thoughts?
Well, I mean, let's also be honest, though. In 2008, when Barack Obama was on his way to becoming the Democratic nominee, it wasn't as if Hillary Clinton supporters were the modicum of graciousness. They said the same exact things in terms of what Bernie Sanders supporters are saying.
I believe she was out of the race by this point several days ago. She withdrew gracefully and told her supporters to support Barack Obama and was, I thought, extremely gracious.
She also did say that she would, carry on the fight. And she did promise to carry on the fight until the convention. Until Barack Obama had to sit down and talk with her. She did.
That is certainly not true. She withdrew from the race and told her supporters to support Barack Obama.
She never said that we should continue on. That was never said in any statement.
If you're saying that Hillary Clinton's behavior in 2008 is anything like Bernie Sanders' behavior right now, that is delusional.
I did not say it's Hillary Clinton. I said her supporters.
And remember that Hillary Clinton, first of all, she is a Democrat. She was a part of that party, and she had her eyes on 2016. She had a lot of reason to eventually fall in
line. And she immediately went into his administration very quickly after he was elected and became a real ally.
And Bernie Sanders doesn't have to keep playing that, doesn't have to advance his career.
He can burn it to the ground, and I think he's going to.
What you were saying, Marcus?
No, but all I'm saying is that, I do agree with Erica in the sense that it does appear that there is a bit of a tantrum that are being thrown here. But at the same time, let's be honest, the superdelegates were put into place. There's a wonderful Mother Jones article on this. We were put into place after George McGovern, another outsider, very similar to Bernie Sanders, at least during that time, came the presumptive Democratic nominee. And it was essentially how do we make sure that, outsiders of this party, no longer have an opportunity, to be our nominee, essentially. So, I mean, in terms of it being undemocratic, I mean, I don't know. It's like those are the rules of the Democratic Party, and, those are the rules that they've abided by these last 20-something years. So
does this unity just happen because, there's going to be Hillary Clinton's presumptively going to be the nominee, and people will just do what they're supposed to do? Or is it going to take a more active bridge building? Wow, we got really mad at each other. Let's get together. Let's go to town hall. Let's have a big old get together and get to know each other again. Remind ourselves how much we have in common. Like how does the coming together happen? Let's say in Washington State.
Well, I think the great unifier will be Donald Trump. I think that's already to some degree in effect, and you have to hammer that message home that the alternative is going to be way worse. There are always some people, particularly when you're trying to incorporate people on the far end of the political spectrum, there are always people whether it's on the right or the left in the activist community who believe that if things get worse, their revolution will happen. And you'll never,
Susan Sarandon.
You'll never convert those folks, the folks at that end of the spectrum. But they're not a majority of people at that end of the spectrum. People will look at the end of the day. I think Donald Trump's impending nomination is going to be very good for the Democratic Party in this state.
I think that one of the great things about Hillary Clinton is she is a conciliatory person. It's something you have to do as a woman leader. And boy, she has just smiled throughout this whole thing. Her victory speech was incredibly gracious. I think she will try to bring people from the Bernie Sanders camp into the fold. But I don't think she's going to concede things that she doesn't believe as part of, I don't think she's going to adopt, push for adopting a party plank that is something that she doesn't agree with. Like, just to throw out an example, universal free college. There are legitimate problems with that plan that Hillary Clinton has laid out, and it would be absurd for her to suddenly turn around, in my opinion, to adopt that just to get the vestiges of Bernie supporters she might be able to get that are willing to live or die on that plank.
Okay, Puget Sound area, Clinton supporters and Sanders supporters, let us know if you are planning to have a unity party. What are you going to do? Are you just going to just assume that, well, there's going to be an anti-Trump vote and it's all going to work out? Or are you going to do a little fence mending? We'd like to hear about it. Maybe we'll send a reporter to your fence mending party. Let us know. We are live tweeting at KUOW. More of the Week in Review coming right back. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Marcus Green, Knute Berger, Erica C. Barnett. This week, we found out what happened to a couple of Seattle college administrators, both African-American, who were chatting in a Starbucks. I asked them, Bob Hughes and Yoshiko Harden, to tell me what happened to them.
It was about 10:30. We were about a half hour into our meeting, and I felt something warm on my face and my forearms, and I thought that someone had tripped and spilled their drink, their warm drink. And so I looked over, and there was a young white male looking at me. And can you swear on radio?
We can try.
Okay. So, and I looked at him, and he said, you know, "F-ing nigger bitch." And I kind of stopped, and it was at that point I realized it was spit on my face and hands, that he had spit on me. And then he kind of wound up to do it again and spit again and got on me again. And for sure, at that point, I saw that it got on Bob and got on his coat. And then he yelled again and just kind of casually walked out. I got up to get some napkins, and he stood at the window and was yelling. We couldn't hear him, but assume he was yelling around the same language, same thing.
And what stood out to Yoshiko and Bob was not only that Yoshiko thought she was about to be killed because of who she was, and she still feels traumatized by that, but the other remarkable thing was that only one person in that whole store did or said anything. It was a mixed race crowd. One white woman called the manager and told Bob and Yoshiko if they needed a witness, they could call her. Other than that, it was crickets. And it's quite a conversation. You can hear the whole conversation at KUOW.org. So my question to you all is, do you think you would have said something? We don't know. We weren't there. Do you feel you heard the interview? Do you think you would have said something?
Well, I want to plug the interview because it's one of the best interviews I've ever heard. Both on the part, your part, Bill, but also the folks you were talking to. It is one of those sort of make you stop and think moments. I mean, I've seen people yelling at each other on the bus. I've walked by a lot of tragedy, which is typical in a city. There's stuff going on. And I wonder, people stare into their phones. We stare into our laptops. We try to tune out these, uncomfortable moments. So I don't know what I would have done. But I can say that the lesson I'm taking away from this and the incredible kind of wisdom and graciousness of the victims here, to me, the message was, it's not intervening in a potentially violent situation, but it's what you do afterwards. The fact that only one person came up and spoke to them, and that whole thing of reminding us what kind of community are you, what kind of community do you want to live in. And I think it's just, I just found it a very powerful reminder that this stuff is not that uncommon. We don't live in a city that's all nice. Outrageous things happen. And if nothing else, providing comfort and support to the people who are the targets is really important.
Marcus, you heard the conversation?
To me, it was just the whole situation was just kind of a microcosm of the city as a whole in terms of its silence on racism, right? If we're supposedly this liberal bastion, but at the end of the day, if you go down to racial discrepancies by what children are expelled the most, who is incarcerated the most, who is living in poverty the most, right? It's really. For the most part, it's no different than Seattle, Washington is no different from parts unknown, Alabama. And yet, you know, we continue to be silent on that as a whole many times. You know, we, for instance, we're building a, there's a detention center being built now on 12th and Alder, right? And it's, while in, you know, here in King County, I believe it's 60% of those incarcerated on any given day are children of color, even though they make up, you know, less than 10% of, you know, our population. And yet, you know, there's very little outcry or uproar on, well, how do we, you know, how do we fix this, essentially? And so for me, the silence, you know, isn't just that one incident. The silence is, you know, something that continues to be systemic in our city.
Eric, I wonder whether you also believe in the connection between a Starbucks bystander moment and a bigger Seattle silence, Seattle distance. This is, I want to play one more piece of audio for you. We can tweet, maybe, Kara, we can tweet the whole conversation out at KUOW. But here's Bob Hughes giving his take on that.
Come and ask me if I'm okay. Don't ignore me. Don't look away. Don't pretend that nothing happened when something really did. We have a, you know, the Seattle nice culture that we talk a lot about and we laugh about it. But underlying that are some really deep truths about who we are as a community in terms of being engaged with people who are different than us.
So a lack of engagement with people who are different from us. Do you see that in their story of what happened to them?
Sure.
At Starbucks?
I do. I think in Seattle, though, I mean, I think it's both. It's also the fact that we don't intervene. And I think that actually might just be a big city thing as well. But I think, you know, in another part of the interview that you didn't play, I mean, it was because my assumption when this was first described to me is, oh, it's a bunch of white people ignoring a couple of people of color, but it was actually like a racially diverse mix of people, according to these two victims.
That's right.
And nobody intervened. And I think we, you know, in a city, get kind of inured to that, to crazy stuff going on and horrible things going on. As Knut said, you know, I ride the bus many times every day, and there's certainly all kinds of things that I just kind of block out. Although, you know, to the question of would you have intervened, I would say for me, it's probably more like 50-50 that I would have, because I'm a sort of confrontational person, and I have intervened on the bus, and I have, you know, made the bus driver stop, and I do yell at people, you know.
As we discussed earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I will. Like, I am, that is just my personality, and it's something that drives me absolutely bonkers about Seattle, that people don't intervene and they just walk by things happening. And I think that's a shame. And of course it becomes, you know, once you enter, you know, this realm of like, oh, that's somebody who's not like me, then you're even less likely to intervene. You know, would a straight person be less likely to intervene in a gay bashing? Would a man be less likely to intervene in, you know, a woman being sexually harassed? I mean, I think that's absolutely a problem, on top of the fact that in this city, you know, we just kind of like, we'll walk over the guy lying in the street.
Why do you think that is true about Seattleites?
Because we like to think that we're this, you know, this bucolic little Mayberry, and nothing ever goes wrong here. And I mean, this is just my experience, having, you know, having lived here for 15 years and kind of gotten used to it. But I think there's this sense that there's no blight, there's nothing, there's no bad people. We're all in this together. And when things happen that contradict that, we tend to kind of just step over them.
You agree with that? We're in denial, and that's why we're passive?
Yes, no, categorically, you know, we're in denial. I think a part of it, too, is that, you know, we don't want to say this because we're, you know, out of niceness, but we live in a segregated city. It's the fifth whitest, I believe, metropolitan city, and it has the 98118 area code, which is the most diverse, you know, area code in the United States. So that tells you most of the color, if you will, is concentrated in one area. What that means is that it also segregates and isolates, you know, many of the concerns and issues, you know, faced by certain people of Seattle. To Erica's point, all the people who say that there's no sexism are, you know, people who don't experience it. All the people who say that there's no homophobia, are, you know, those who, you know, aren't scared to walk down the street with their partners, as many are in the Capitol Hill area. Those who say that there's no racism are people who don't experience racism. So I think it's one of those things where ignorance becomes the lived reality for so many people, too many people.
Well, even if you don't see yourself as a hero, or if you don't think you know exactly what to do or what to say, the final thing I remember so much from my conversation was that, because I was telling them the downside, the difficult parts about intervening in a situation like this. For one thing, how self-congratulatory and sort of useless and patronizing is it for me to stand up afterward and say, I do not stand with that person. But they said, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect. Just, you know, ask me if I'm okay.
Right.
Just the simplest, it's something instead of nothing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, putting your own personal safety at risk is not a good idea either. If it's, you know, say it was a violent situation, you know, I'm not going to probably throw my body in the middle of that. But that doesn't mean I can't say, hey, you know, are you okay? Do you want me to chase that guy down? Well, that's my instinct. I got mugged once and I chased the guy down.
Wow.
But, you know, can I do something?
Something.
Just something, yeah. And I think that we do need to do more of that. And that's, you know, that's a problem that has a lot of causes, but it is pretty bad in Seattle.
You're not perfect, Seattle, but you can do better. This is KUOW's Week in Review. We're going to talk about whether you can do better in the face of impending disaster in just a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This week, Washington emergency responders have been running a drill, a series of rehearsals for a future 9.0 magnitude earthquake. You can find our coverage of that drill at KUOW.org. I talked with a local truck driver named Tom Martin, who helped found the American Preppers Network. Preppers are folks who are prepped, prepared for disaster. In case of chaos and deprivation, they've got plenty of food and water and possibly ammo. Now, there's a common stereotype of preppers that they are paranoid, anti-government, every man for himself curmudgeons. I didn't find Tom Martin self-centered. In fact, he told us why, if you're not a prepper, you're the one who's selfish.
You have all these able-bodied people that otherwise could have been prepared now, won't be prepared, and they're going to be absorbing all the resources of the first responders that are trying to rescue them. And I think that's wrong. I think the first responders should have their attention focused 100% on the people who can't take care of themselves, you know, people that are in, you know, retirement homes and disabled and the elderly.
I never quite thought of it that way, Erica. Do you have a moral obligation to be a prepper?
Well, there's a lot of challenges to actually carrying that out, but I do agree with him that, you know, we should be more prepared than we are. In preparation for this conversation, I went back and looked at a 2007 piece I did about the bird flu. And that was the point at which I became super paranoid that we were going to be, you know, in a pandemic, which is a little different than an earthquake. But we had the place I was living at the time was a large place. We had a basement and we had 6 weeks worth of food and water and everything and emergency supplies down there. And part of it was out of a feeling of obligation. You know, we don't want to be sucking resources away from the people, you know, who really need it. People, you know, in hospitals and people who, you know, can't get around. And but part of it also was we lived in a house and we had a lot of space and I live in a teeny tiny apartment now and I can't prepare for anything, so I'm going to be the ones leeching off people like your truck driver there because I just frankly don't have the room, and half of Seattle doesn't have the room. I would say, you know, like lots and lots of people live in apartments, so house owners, take it as a tip. Prepare to help me
if you have a house. Prepare to help Erica C. Barnett. Marcus, agreed? Moral obligation? Be a prepper or you're not a good person? Not as good as you thought you were?
Well, like, I mean, yes. I mean, obviously, ideally, you'd want to be prepared and everything else. But, I mean, you know, I, for instance, live in an area where, you know, you have several people who are, you know, busy enough just, you know, prepping for, you know, the next day, let alone, you know, some earthquake, which to them is, you know, seems very, you know, far off or, you know, esoteric, or, you know, in the terms of, yeah, sure, it could potentially happen.
So chaos and deprivation is not just theoretical.
No.
To everybody.
No. I mean, they're like, you know, I just have chaos in my normal day, you know, let alone, right. You know, I have, you know, so you're saying that I should also, you know, take the very few scarce resources I have and, you know, prep them or have some bunker, but you know, beneath my basement at this point.
That's a good point. It's not just the luxury you have of space, but it's assuming that you've got so much resources that you can spend now for stuff that's just going to be on, you know, sitting in reserve.
Yeah, and that was a big concern for me at the time. I mean, I was like, why are we wasting all this money? And fortunately, I had the money, you know, that I could waste. I mean, our supplies were not great. You know, we had like cans of Chef Boyardee from the cash and carry. Okay, so, you know, we did what we could afford. But you're right. A lot of people can't. A lot of people don't have the time, the space, the car to go get a bunch of stuff. So I don't think it's a moral obligation for everybody. Everybody's circumstances are different. But I think if you can, it's actually, I mean, I tend more toward the prepper end of things. You know, if you are able to do it and you have the resources, you should be somewhat prepared for, you know, for a couple weeks.
Knut, are you prepped?
Oh, only partially. I've, you know, got some canned food that I put away in 2002,
mm-hmm.
you know, so inedible, you know, I have some water.
You have a can opener, right?
I have a can opener. Okay, yeah. No, I have some stuff set aside. The problem with these disaster scenarios is you don't know when they'll happen. They could happen 500 years from now. They could happen tomorrow. You don't know what kind of mix. I sort of assume that the apartment I live in currently will be wiped out in a seiche or a tsunami. It's also brick, so you know, we'll probably be.
It's been nice knowing you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if I were really, really into the guy, you know, I have to be prepared for any eventuality, I'd move. I mean, we live in
that's
you
a
know,
good point.
In
that
area
would be,
that's
yeah.
just completely riddled with fault lines and, you know, a giant volcano and potential disaster. So, I mean, you cannot be prepared for every scenario. You don't even know if you'll be home.
That's right. That's assuming that you're going to be near all
yeah,
that stuff
I know.
You
People,
stockpiled.
It's like, and I remember as a kid. I mean,
Marcus,
I,
you're looking upset. Sorry. How you doing? Oh, you okay?
Okay.
You're okay.
Yeah, yeah. Over caffeinated, yeah. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You know, I think you can get too into the sort of whole bomb shelter, you know, mentality. But I also think taking some basic precautions is really good.
All right. Well, we only have enough resources in this room to last for another minute or so, and then we're going to have to start eating the microphones. So,
or each other.
Or each other. Yeah, we're going to have to figure out whose life is worth more. I wish you could join us for that, but we're going to have to wrap up the show. So can we continue this conversation in just a moment?
Yeah, after we draw straws.
Yeah, yeah. Marshall, your best arguments. Erica Barnett, Erica C. Barnett writes at the C is for crank.com. Marcus Green is editor for the community news website South Seattle Emerald, contributes to Yes Magazine. Knut Berger contributes to Crosscut, where he is the Mossback. Thanks, everybody, for joining me.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
We're always at KUOW on Twitter, Facebook page. Come join us there and come see us at kuow.org.